Our occasional series, The Long View, profiles people of long experience, this week in show business. At 97 years old, Lupita Tovar has a very long view. As a child in Mexico, she saw Pancho Villa's Rebels. As a teenager in Mexico City, she was discovered at the dawn of the talking picture. An American talent scout had come to her school, and she found herself among dozens of girls taking a screen test. Her big moment came when the talent scout directed her to Imagine Your Mother Has Died, and she wept.
Tears started rolling down, you know, that he got up and he said, I will see you in Hollywood.
Lupita Tovar's Los Angeles living room is filled with the memories of those early Hollywood days. Awards crowd the top of a grand piano and photographs of the black-haired beauty she was and still is. This cozy scene contrasts with the spooky scenery of her first big movies. The silent hit, The Cat Creeps, which earned her back home the title The Sweetheart of Mexico, and the Spanish language, Dracula.
Soy Drácula.
Drácula vino, se abrió una vena del brazo y me hizo beber.
The young actress came to star in Dracula because Hollywood studios had realized they could make money from foreign language films. So when Universal shot Dracula with Bela Lugosi, a Spanish language cast was waiting in the shadows.
We work at night, from 7 o'clock in the evening to 7 in the morning. The English picture was in the daytime.
On the same sets.
On the same set.
That Bela Lugosi was making English drama.
Bela Lugosi was in the daytime.
Did you cross paths?
No, I never met him. I came in at 7. They had cobwebs everywhere and make it very eerie, you know. And so I got scared when I came into the set. I always like to be early. And I got there and I sat there in the dark. And about 3 o'clock in the morning, when we were very, very tired, something would drop by my side. It was a Hershey bar from the electrician on top.
No doubt an admirer. Was there a difference between the two Draculas other than just language?
Yes. The wardrobe. My wardrobe was the sexiest ever. You know, they gave me this negligee and transparent, you know. Well, it was a different wardrobe than the American. Helen Chandler was very, you know, so.
She's very demure.
And me, I was very sexy.
Lupita Tovar's next big role, Mexico's first talking movie. Santa was based on a famous novel about the travails of a country girl still in braids.
Niña Santita. Adios. Adios, Juanito. Hasta mañana.
She falls for a dashing soldier who seduces and then abandons her.
That's right. Yeah.
Very innocent.
Very innocent. And then becomes the most famous prostitute of Mexico. Now, I had no idea.
What the story was.
I thought it was about a saint.
Santa. So you said Santa, sounds like a good project.
I immediately said yes.
In that film, you're so beautiful. Yeah. You're 21.
No, I was 20.
20.
Because that was 1930.
Yeah.
I was born in 1910.
What's your best memory about making Santa?
It was like a family. And they had no money. And my mother always complained. They borrowed from her a rocking chair and it never came back, you know. We were helping each other with makeup, with everything. It was fun.
The costumes were beautiful. That in the brothel, the prostitutes
the
wore.
That was. I tell you, we designed our own.
You just made them yourselves?
Yeah.
So Santa became a major cinematic milestone in Mexican cinema.
Yes,
so,
it was the first talking picture in Mexico, you know.
Was there a stamp made with your
image
in Mexico?
Stamp. Yes. I think it's in the piano there.
Can I pick it up?
Yeah.
This is so great. Your stamp, your postage stamp.
That's my stamp. Yeah.
There you are, the glamorous harlot in the brothel. And that is...
That is Martinez Casado, who played the bullfighter.
The bullfighter who loved you.
Yeah.
The man who loved Lupita in real life was a Czech immigre who'd produced the Spanish Dracula. Paul Koner would go on to become a top agent and by the 1950s was representing John Huston, Orson Welles, and Ingmar Bergman. But in 1932, Koner was headed to Europe to make movies, and with him, Lupita Tovar. They were married in Berlin. When you and your husband, Paul Koner, went to Berlin, this was the moment that
then,
Hitler was rising.
That's when Hitler came. Mm. And then I was offered a film. The producer sent the script, and he says, would you like to do it? And I said, yes. He said, there is only one condition. During the filming, you will have to live in a hotel as Miss Tovar, not as Mrs. Koner.
And why?
Because my husband was Jewish, see. I got up, I took the script, and I said, and you know what you can do with it, and I walk out. My husband laughed like the Dickens. But, you know, I can never keep my mouth shut. I feel something, I mean, I'll say it.
And you made many other movies for
a
time.
I worked at Columbia. I made 10 Cents a Dance, which was a big success. And I make a lot of westerns. I made South of the Border with Gene Autry.
Do you ever miss acting, being in the movies?
I haven't thought about it. Hmm. I think life, we are always acting. Anyway, yeah, sometimes, you know, I'm here alone at night and I start thinking back. Would I change anything? No. I will do exactly what I did. Yeah.
Santa mia, alumbra con tu luz.
Lupita Tovar was married to Paul Koner for 56 years. Her son Pancho is a producer, her daughter Susan an actress nominated for an Oscar for Imitation of Life. And you may have heard of her grandsons, the directors Chris and Paul Weitz, who made their names in Hollywood with American Pie and About a Boy. You can see some glamorous publicity stills of Lupita Tovar at NPR.org. We've dusted off some old theme music to remember a man who was nicknamed the Old Redhead. The late Red Barber owned this part of the show for years as he chatted live with our former host, Bob Edwards.
Red Barber joins us now from Tallahassee, Florida. Red, good morning.
It's a good morning, Colonel. And in this troubled world of ours, I am happy to report to you that the camellias are beginning to show their blossoms here in Tallahassee.
Red Barber was a legendary sports broadcaster who told tales about those camellias and the greatest moments in sports with equal grace. His 100th birthday would have been this weekend. NPR's Ketzel Levine has this remembrance.
Once upon a time, felines and flowers had it all over drugs in the sports news.
Well, let's see. We have some excitement Sunday, don't we? The United States Football League's championship game. I'm sure you're all up for that.
Well, I think the people down in Tampa are very excited about it. But by the way, Bob, something serious and sporting is going on down here in my front yard. There's a mockingbird that's got a nest, and he's got some young ones in there. And you know about our Abyssinian cat, Arwe.
Yes, I certainly
His
do.
Life is now miserable. He likes to go out, but he doesn't anymore. He's just hanging inside because I want to tell you that the father mockingbird is a rough customer. He is dive-bombing our cat.
I don't blame him.
And now with the mockingbird, he doesn't want to go out.
Well, keep your eye on that situation, and we'll get an update next Friday, okay?
Okay, Robert. Good
Red,
luck.
Thank you much. The comments of Red Barber.
Red Barber was my father's hero, the radio voice of my father's team, the Brooklyn Dodgers. So when NPR launched Morning Edition and I took on the sports segment, the temptation was too great, all that power. To delight my dad, I booked Red, who went on for a dozen years to delight you.
Last week, we talked about spring training for broadcasters and how broadcasters use spring training to get back into shape. Does a broadcaster have to retrain the eye to follow the ball when a new season begins?
Bob, you're bringing up a point that you follow the ball from the moment that it is hit, but then you pick up the defensive ball player. A lot of broadcasters make the mistake of trying to judge that a ball's going to go in the stands, and then it gets caught by an outfielder, and then they've got egg on their face. And I understand you've got a call that I made in the World Series of 1947, which is a matter of broadcasting technique, I think might be interesting.
Okay, game six, and it's the bottom of the sixth, two men on, and the Dodgers are leading 8-5.
Joe DiMaggio up, and the crowd well knows that one swing of this bat, this fellow's capable of making it a brand-new game again. Outfield deep, round toward left, the infield overshifted. Here's the pitch. Swung on, belted. It's a long one. Deep in the left center. Back goes Gianfrido. Back. He makes a one-handed catch against the bullpen. Oh, doctor.
So the crowd was watching the ball. You were watching Al Gianfrido.
Well, that's what I learned, Bob, when I first got to the big leagues in 1934. I always go with the outfielder. And if the ball goes into the stands, he will look up and watch it go into the stands with you.
Well, thanks for another lesson, Red. Talk to you next week.
Okay, buddy.
This month, as baseball spring training gets started once again, we salute Red Barber, oh, doctor, who put us all in the catbird seat each Friday morning, bringing life to sports and sports to life. Ketzel Levine, NPR News, Washington.
And I know that was too short. It was always too short. We've got lots more of Red Barber's colorful comments at npr.org, so you can listen to more.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Melissa Block. A prayer movement has sprung up in a handful of churches in the middle of the country. The focus is, of all things, Interstate Highway 35, which stretches from Texas to Minnesota. The participants believe that if enough people pray hard enough, God will touch the communities along the interstate. As NPR's John Burnett reports, some people along the freeway don't especially want to be prayed for.
What a rich slice of Americana on this chilly Friday night on Cedar Springs Boulevard in Dallas. Two dozen young people from Heartland World Ministries Church sing songs of praise on a street corner in what they believe to be the Lion's Den, Dallas's gay bar district.
Jesus!
In a secular counterpoint to the worshipers, up the block, a transvestite busker in a blonde wig and leopard print miniskirt who goes by the name Large Marge strikes up a favorite.
Close your eyes and I'll get you.
In the middle of this street tableau, a disheveled man walks up, hands his quart beer bottle to his buddy, and asks the church group to pray for him. The group's leader, a former Alabama drug addict turned evangelist named Joe Oden, puts his hand on the alcoholic's forehead.
He said he wants God to deliver him from this situation. Fire of the Spirit of God burning him.
We'll return to the prayer warriors in a moment. They belong to a Pentecostal, evangelical branch of conservative Christianity, and they're part of an unusual prayer movement with a small M that began with this woman.
One day we were praying, and we were reading Isaiah 35, and Isaiah 35, verse 8, talks about a highway of holiness. And we were thinking, wouldn't it be wonderful if along this highway 35 here, that there was a special time where God just touched everybody that lives on all parts of this highway.
Cindy Jacobs is a petite, intense woman with an indelible smile who heads a prayer ministry called Generals International. She stands in front of her headquarters in an office park south of Dallas, overlooking the prophetic freeway.
And so we develop a prayer strategy, and we had people pray from Laredo to Duluth, Minnesota, and prayed for 35 days. We prayed about such issues as eliminating systemic poverty. We prayed for safety. We prayed for people that are caught in drug addictions and trapped in their life and hopeless. It was marvelous. It was just a great time.
The prayers continued after the 35 days were over, and now the movement has a name, Light the Highway. Its website lists 22 churches and prayer groups along the interstate. in Laredo, San Antonio, Austin, Dallas, Oklahoma City, Kansas City, Des Moines, Minneapolis, and Duluth, to name a few cities. Will travelers think it's strange when they see a cluster of people, heads bowed and hands uplifted, on a grassy strip beside the highway? Steve Hill, the 54-year-old senior pastor at Heartland World Ministries in the Dallas suburb of Irving, is not concerned.
What would you rather have, a group of young people praying on I-35 or a group of young people dealing drugs on I-35? Take your pick, okay?
Though Light the Highway is not widely known, there's considerable skepticism within the steepled sanctuary of the Perkins School of Theology at Southern Methodist University in Dallas, where William Lawrence is dean.
America is full of religious groups that are testing the boundaries of what is possible to believe, much of which will have a very ephemeral lifespan and will fade from the scene because it's without substance.
On the whole, Lawrence looks askance at impersonal prayers for passing motorists.
Tossing out words to God as if I want to pray for the guy in the semi with the Louisiana license plate on it is not anything close to the encounter where somebody engages in what I know has been practiced in many places, truck stop ministries.
Yet roadside supplication is not all they do. Heartland World Ministries, the church at the center of Light the Highway, sends prayer teams into jails, malls, well-to-do neighborhoods, and Dallas's gay bar district. Joe Oden is the church's evangelism pastor.
We don't believe that God is going to come down and touch the asphalt, but we believe that God is going to touch the people from the corridor of Laredo to Minneapolis, Minnesota. And we're right off of I-35 here. And so this is an area where people are. And we believe with Light the Highway that everyone needs Jesus. Caucasian people, black people, heterosexuals, homosexuals.
Especially gay people. Every Friday night, a prayer team comes down here to Cedar Springs to conduct what they call a purity siege, hoping to set off a sort of mass repentance. While they are sometimes heckled, on this night, interactions with club patrons are civil. A 22-year-old evangelist from Little Rock named Kevin Wilkes has challenged a 49-year-old Dallas interior designer named Kyle Perkins to reconsider his lifestyle.
Just to be honest, you know, this is darkness out here.
No, it's not.
Oh, this is darkness, Kyle. No, see, we're supposed to be light and salt of the earth. The Bible says that friendship with the world is to be at enemy.
And what's dark around here?
What's dark?
Uh-huh.
Sexual perversion. Idolatry lifted up in their own hearts.
There's no idolatry on these corners or anything. I don't see a graven image brought up on any corner here or anything.
Actually, that's the second commandment. The first one is put in.
Writ large, this is more than a dialogue between a street preacher and a gay interior designer. It's a snatch of the same debate that's tearing apart Protestant denominations along every interstate in America.
See, the truth is graven on your heart, Cal. God loved you so much, He put the truth on your heart.
And I still do not think I'm doing wrong. I think I was created this way. God created me a homosexual, and I'm perfectly happy that way. And I'm going to be to heaven, and I'm sure you're going to be in heaven, too.
I am. And, Cal, the scripture says...
While this church group seeks to light the highway with the redeemed souls of sinners, some people along congested Interstate 35 might request a different sort of supernatural intervention. How about fewer traffic jams? John Burnett, NPR News, Austin.
Come on, Holy
Healthcare is one of the top issues voters say they're concerned about, along with the economy and the Iraq War. Family physician and commentator Douglas Camero has examined the healthcare platforms of all the leading presidential candidates and finds something missing.
The presidential candidates agree about the nature of the problem. Healthcare is too expensive, too many of us are uninsured, there are too many medical errors, and the quality of care is not as good as it could be. And the candidates also agree on many of the changes that are needed to fix things. An increased emphasis on preventive medicine and chronic disease care, wider use of computerized medical records to decrease errors and improve care, and more health and healthcare information for patients. But unless I'm missing something, all of the major candidates ignore a very important issue in their proposals. My search of the healthcare platforms of the candidates failed to find a single mention of the term primary care. Does no one realize that the current woeful state of primary care medicine in the U.S. is both a likely cause of many of our problems as well as a potential solution for them? Primary care doctors include family physicians, general internists, and most pediatricians. They're our first contact with healthcare, and they provide ongoing continuity of care. The advantages of a strong primary care system have been proven in studies around the world. Where there's good primary care, patients have reduced death rates and better outcomes from heart and lung diseases. They're hospitalized less frequently and use emergency services more appropriately. Strong primary care is associated with better delivery of preventive medicine and more early detection of cancer. Patient satisfaction is better in primary care patients. And finally, medical care delivered by primary care clinicians costs less and uses fewer tests. And by the way, outcomes are similar. All of which argues that we should have a vigorous primary care system. But we don't. Primary care in the U.S. is in crisis and things are getting worse. Currently, primary care doctors comprise about 35% of our medical workforce, compared to half or more in most industrialized countries. The number of medical students choosing family medicine has decreased by half in the last 10 years. The proportion of internal medicine residents who plan careers in primary care instead of a specialty like cardiology also decreased by half. So not only are there too few primary care doctors, but their numbers are dwindling. What will it take to reverse these trends? First, primary care doctors should be paid more. It's no surprise that medical students, many of whom have huge student loans to pay off, choose to become surgeons or dermatologists and get paid at least twice as much as primary care doctors. Second, counseling and other time-intensive but low-tech primary care services should be reimbursed generously, as should non-traditional services such as group visits and email care. Finally, there should be incentives for medical students to enter primary care. Loan forgiveness programs for primary care doctors would make higher-paying specialties less attractive and ease young doctors' transition into primary care practice. Primary care medicine is a crucial missing piece of the healthcare puzzle. It needs to be a part of the proposals of all the presidential candidates.
Douglas Camero is a health services researcher at RTI International and a former assistant surgeon general.
Being head of state in Italy is hardly a stable job. The government has changed hands at least 60 times since World War II. So the most recent government collapse wasn't a surprise, and it also isn't much of a surprise that Italy's longest-running leader is trying to come back to power. Former Prime Minister and media tycoon Silvio Berlusconi is the favorite candidate for the April elections, according to polls. He isn't exactly known for being a nice guy, but his new opponent is, as NPR's Silvia Pagioli reports from Rome.
At election time in Italy, a late-night TV talk show is the most important campaign stop. On Tuesday night, the guest of honor was former right-wing Prime Minister Silvio Berlusconi. 71 years old, he's running for the fifth time, and he's selling himself as the man of the hour. I still feel like I'm 35 years old, he said. And as my mommy used to say, if a person feels the duty to do something, he has to find the courage to do it. Today, he added, it appears that in order to put the political world in order, Silvio Berlusconi is still indispensable. Berlusconi ran government for 5 years, a record in Italy, but he wasn't re-elected and was criticized by European Union officials for not curbing rampant tax evasion and for swelling Italy's public debt, making it the highest in Europe. Berlusconi counters that his successor raised taxes too high and accuses judges of harassing him by constantly accusing him of corruption.
Noi crediamo di poter garantire.
We can guarantee Italians freedom of oppression, he said, from red tape, from taxes, and from the judiciary. Polls show Berlusconi in the lead, taking advantage of popular disgust with the outgoing nine-party coalition. But the climate has sharply changed from elections 2 years ago. A recent bestseller about the Italian political elite raised the curtain on a system of entrenched privileges for the best-paid politicians in Europe, with lavish perks unheard of elsewhere. Surveys show a growing public anger and disdain for politicians both on the left and right. Restaurant owner Paolo Bistazzoni considers himself a hardline right-winger.
The system can't go on. We're warning them. If they don't change things, they too will go home after a year and a half. Italians can't stand this waste any longer.
While Berlusconi is flashy with tinted hair and facelifts, his new rival on the left is just the opposite. Clean-cut 52-year-old Walter Veltroni is nicknamed Mr. Nice Guy. A former communist who openly adores American culture, Veltroni just stepped down as the popular two-term mayor of Rome. As leader of the new Democratic Party, he has modeled his campaign after Barack Obama's.
Yes, we can.
Yes, we can.
Barack Obama ha cominciato a pronunciarla.
Yes, we can. Yes, we can, Veltroni says, adding Barack Obama first said this when the road seemed closed and now it's wide open. The slogan has been translated as si può fare and put to music.
Si può fare, si può fare. Puoi prendere o lasciare, puoi volere, puoi lottare.
In a major break with the past, Veltroni has vowed his party will run alone, not in coalition with little parties that analysts say are in great part responsible for Italy's unstable governments and legislative paralysis.
È del paese del veto.
Italy is standing still because this is a country of vetoes. Everyone has to veto something, he says. Decisions are never taken. No one is accountable. With a veto, you have the certainty nothing will go forward. Then you wield power by negotiating over lifting your veto. This has to stop, Veltroni adds. We need a democracy that takes decisions. Polls show that Veltroni's risky solo strategy is paying off. He has narrowed the gap with Berlusconi. The election campaign has just started, and the two main rivals will have to compete hard to win over voters. Polls show that with 2 months to go, 30% of Italians are still undecided. Silvia Poggioli, NPR News, Rome.
And here in California, two civil liberties groups are suing the federal government over its policy of seizing electronics, like cell phones and laptops, from U.S. residents who are returning to the country after a trip abroad. The groups want the government to explain how it decides who to target for these searches and seizures. But the government insists it has the right to this information any time a person comes back into the country. NPR's Richard Gonzalez reports.
Nabila Mango is a naturalized U.S. citizen who came to this country more than 40 years ago. Last December, she returned from a three-week trip to the Middle East. Customs agents at the San Francisco airport demanded to know the names of everyone she met in Jordan and the address of every place she visited. They also wanted to know the name, address, and occupation of her American-born daughter. She says they also seized her cell phone. When it was returned, the record of her recent calls had been erased.
I felt really I lost all my civil rights, my human rights in this country, and I was worried about my safety, the safety of my daughter, the safety of my friends, the safety of everyone who was on my cell phone.
Mango is one of more than 20 travelers, both citizens and non-citizens, mainly of Muslim, Middle Eastern, or South Asian background, who say they were questioned about their religious practices and political beliefs. They also had their laptops and cell phones searched, and in some cases, they say, information from their electronic devices was copied. Susan Gurley, director of the Association of Corporate Travel Executives, has heard similar complaints from business travelers. Her group is concerned with the personal and business information extracted by customs officials.
And that's the question for us. What happens with that information once it's copied? Where does it go? Whom is it shared with? When is it destroyed? How long is it stored? And we have not really received adequate explanation from the U.S. government regarding these questions.
Now, two San Francisco-based civil liberties groups, the Asian Law Caucus and the Electronic Frontier Foundation, are suing the Department of Homeland Security. They want the government to explain its policy for border searches and the rules for seizing and copying the contents of laptops and other devices. Shireen Sinar is an attorney with the Asian Law Caucus.
When the government searches your books, examines your computer, and demands to know your political beliefs, it sends a message that the First Amendment disappears at our nation's doorstep.
A spokeswoman for U.S. Customs and Border Protection declined to comment on the pending suit, but in a written statement, she said laptop computers can be detained if they contain information about possible ties to terrorism, narcotic smuggling, child pornography, or other criminal activity. But the question is, how is the decision made over which laptops to search? Oren Kerr specializes in computer crime law at George Washington University. He says the federal government has a good reason not to disclose how it makes those calls.
If the government has to disclose what policies it's following, then if you want to circumvent that policy, the disclosure gives you a recipe to do that.
Furthermore, Kerr says, the two civil liberties groups have no case.
The Supreme Court has said quite clearly that at the border, the government has very strong powers to search and seize. This is a rule going back hundreds of years. So this is a well-established exception to the Fourth Amendment warrant requirement. And I don't think courts are going to be eager to basically temper that by saying that whatever the policies are have to be disclosed and known.
Still, Susan Gurley of the Association of Corporate Travel Executives offers this advice for her clients. If you don't want your personal or proprietary business information shared with the government, then don't bring it. Richard Gonzalez, NPR News, San Francisco.